Let's start the book of Hebrews today. Let's go into the final section on this section about the promise and the hope. And today we're in 12:1-13. That is faith. That's living out the promise. We have a promise. We want to live that out. This section, 12:1-13, is to encourage us to continue in the faith in the midst of temptation. And not to turn away from following Jesus, who is totally faithful. He calls us to be faithful. Keep following Him. And the temptation to turn away is part of our condition. Fallen beings. And so the act of turning away is that constant pull within us. And then we have encouragement from outside as well. Temptations come from outside the world. But our own pride inside ourselves. And we can turn away from Jesus Christ. It doesn't mean we're not saved. It means we're failures at points in our lives. And sometimes it's the very failure that God will use. He will accomplish great things even though we fail. Well, let's pray. Thanks, Bill. Great. Okay, so this section, 12:1-13 in the book of Hebrews, I call it faith is running to win. And it's faith that endures discipline. Now, running to win. This is the name of Erwin Lutzer's radio site. Radio ministry is called Running to Win. He gets it from this passage. The idea behind it is faith that endures discipline. This whole section, 11:1-12:13, is linked to Hebrews 10:36-39. 10:36, he says very plainly, it's not hard to understand, you have need of endurance so that when you've done the will of God, you receive what was promised. And if you don't have endurance, you will shrink back and God will not be pleased with you. And you can ruin your life. So perseverance is not automatic. It's not inevitable. Just because a person becomes a Christian does not mean he is going to be able to endure in every trial. It's our choice to obey and our choice to be blessed, or it's our choice to shrink back and to lose God's testimony. And you're going to see how that really links as we get into chapter 12. Paul has the same idea. You work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. That's you doing that. Why would you want to do that? Well, there's God's working in you. That's the divine side of this, both for you to will and to work for His good pleasure. God will work in you that you will want to obey His will and you will want to do His work. But if you do not obey Him, do not honor Him, He's going to let you go your own way, perhaps. The faith of a child of God can be eroded by constant exposure to harsh circumstances. This is very, very difficult. There's all kinds of circumstances you can think of. But I'm just going to focus on two. There's prosperity. We don't think of prosperity being a harsh circumstance. Prosperity can be a great temptation, a great eroder to the Christian faith. Now let's go to the other side. I'm just going to go two extremes. Persecution. Persecution can certainly be disheartening for the child of God. So persecution is foreign to us in America. But it is not foreign to Christians in other parts of the world. Now, there's the other side of it. It's this. This is a book that came out in 1985. It's called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Neil Postman. This is public discourse in the age of show business. Let's look at some quotes from Neil Postman from this book. I think these are notable things. Now, this book came out, again, as I said, in 1985. I believe I'm not mistaken in saying that Christianity is a demanding and serious religion. When it is delivered as easy and amusing, it is another kind of religion altogether. We're more interested in, am I going to be entertained when I go to church? Am I going to have to go and do some work or perhaps be confronted? There's another thing he said. There's nothing wrong with entertainment. We all build castles in the air. We all have fantasies. We all like stories. The problem is when we try to live in them. Entertainment has become such a huge part of our culture that we put entertainers and personalities above everything else. If somebody has a powerful personality, they'll win the day, even if they're totally unprincipled in their lives. You can be swayed by a personality that's very powerful and very potent, but it's totally immoral, and they will lead you to destruction. So you must place your principles before personalities. And I think that's important. I think we've lost sight of that in our entertainment economy. And then there's another one. This one I really like. People will come to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. And I put on their Twitter. To me, I don't know about you, but even the name Twitter denotes trivial or trite. And so it seems like trivial or trite, but it also can be very inflammatory. And I think Twitter and things like it can have a profound impact when used for evil, because so many people can be reached. I wonder what Adolf Hitler could have done had he had the technology of a Twitter. The enemies of Christianity are not always the persecutors. Sometimes they're within our own culture and the culture that we become comfortable in. Paul said to the Ephesian elders, the false teachers are going to arise from within your own selves. There's no such thing as a static institution in Christianity. All institutions deteriorate because the seeds of destruction are within them. Let's get into the book of Hebrews. Let's look at 12, 1 through 3. This is a call to run. Now, this section is set up very nicely. There's a call to run in the first three verses, and then in the last two verses, there's a call to renew. The middle answers the question, why suffering? Why is there suffering? And C.S. Lewis said that suffering and pain is God's megaphone to get your attention. So we're going to go to 1 through 3, the call to run. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. That's all one sentence in the Greek New Testament. Our translators have broken that up into two sentences, but it all continues in one sentence, and the focus is on Jesus. He's the center of the sentence, as he should be. Let's go through this sentence a little bit. He says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses, that word witnesses is the same exact word used in 11:2 and 11:39, and we don't see it as witness there. In 11:2, it says, for by faith, men of old gained approval. That's the word witness. Same word we have there in 12:1, witnesses, martyro, the word martyr. One who gives a testimony. But these men of old have gained God's testimony, have gained God's approval. 11:39, same thing. All these having gained approval by their faith. By it, they gained approval. By from whom? From God. So we have this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us. The witnesses he's talking to in 12:1 are the witnesses he's just talked about in 11 that we have. Doesn't mean that they're witnesses like watching what we're doing. They are witnesses for faith to tell us what faith looks like. So they are witnessing what faith is to us. And it's written down here by this author of the book of Hebrews in a very concise, nice way, so that we can take all of these lives and look at them and go, well, I can learn from that. I can learn from that. Like, look at this. It says, let us also lay aside every encumbrance, like Moses. He laid aside the riches of Egypt because he saw the riches of Christ, and he focused on that. And we have another example. And the sin which easily entangles us. You talk about two men in the list, Samson and David. And yet they both have victory in their lives. In spite of the bitterness they cause in their own lives and the lives of others, they still end up having victory. Let us lay aside and let us run. We've got this cloud of witnesses who've witnessed to us, so let's run with endurance. So that's what he says, let us run with endurance. Why does he say run with endurance? Because Jesus has sat down. Well, that doesn't seem fair. We got to run and he gets to sit? He sat down because he has accomplished the greatest priestly sacrifice that could be accomplished. He sat down, perfect tense. What he did is abiding forever. A perfect sacrifice by a perfect priest. You know, you go back to 1:3. This is how the book starts. It's talking about Jesus. Jesus is the radiance of his glory, of God's glory, the exact representation of God's nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, and how did he do that? We found in the book of Hebrews how he did it, see? He sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become much better than angels. 10:12. Look at 10:12. He, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, for all sin for all time. He sat down at the right hand of God, according to Psalm 110:1. Psalm 110:1, the center psalm of this book, Psalm 110. It's quoted several times. Waiting, look at what his ministry is, to wait from that time onward until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet. Now, he sat down at the right hand of God. Why? Because he'd made purification of sins, which is a function of the priest. And he's a Melchizedekian priest, isn't he? We all know what that is now, don't we? Who Melchizedek is and why Jesus is a Melchizedekian priest, a better priest. And he sits down until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet. That's, again, quoting Psalm 110:1. He's waiting until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet when he will be installed as king. So he's priest first in time, and then he's king in time. He holds both offices, but he's not functioning as king now today, is he? He's functioning as a priest today. 10:14, for by one offering he's perfected for all time those who are sanctified. All time, all sin, one offering. Abraham in 11:10 was looking for the city. He focused on the city, the place. Look at verse 16. His sons, Isaac and Jacob, as it is, they desire a better country, a heavenly one. God is not ashamed to be called their God. In fact, God is giving his approval of them. He has prepared what? A city for them. They hold this promise that God has a place prepared for them, and they fix their eyes on that. Look at Moses, 11:25. Choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. He set aside that encumbrance, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Look at his focus. It's the Messiah. And the reproach of the Messiah, not the glory of the Messiah. He fixed his eyes on that. So the total focus in this book is on the hope based on the promise. Go back to chapter 6. Look at 6:19. This hope, which he's argued is based on the promise that God made, this hope we have is what? An anchor to the soul. And an anchor is fixed, both sure and steadfast, and the one which enters within the veil. That's the anchor that goes within the veil, where Jesus has entered, and he's the one who took the anchor in there. In fact, he is the anchor, has entered as a forerunner, as a captain, as a leader, getting us through this jungle of life, having become a high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. And because he's a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek, he makes a perfect sacrifice for all sin for all time. We just read that in chapter 10. Now, what's cloud? Why does he call him a cloud of witness? Why cloud? Because these are Old Testament saints. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, they're all Old Testament saints who are in heaven with Jesus in spiritual bodies. Why don't they have glorified bodies? Because the resurrection has not yet taken place. Only one person has been resurrected. That's Jesus. And he's waiting. And when he comes back, we will be resurrected. They will be resurrected, each in his own order, it says in 1 Corinthians. So they're a cloud. If we would try to see them, we couldn't see them because they're spiritual beings right now. We could only see them if God had ordained that they should appear, which Moses and Elijah did appear at the Mount of Transfiguration in what looked like bodies to Peter, James, and John. No, they're spiritual bodies, like angelic bodies that could be seen for a brief period of time. So what's he say to do? He says, run, man. Run in 12. Run and let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, laying aside every encumbrance. What's an encumbrance? Well, look at this guy. He's got a blanket roll, he's got a backpack, he's got a camera, and he's trying to run a race. You think he would do better if he laid that stuff down?
Yeah.
Yeah. These encumbrances are neutral things, or they're good things that hold you back. If you don't care about winning, hang on to them. But the writer of Hebrews is saying, I want to encourage you to run in a way that you win. And then lay aside every sin. Now, I don't see he's got a blanket roll, he's got a back... Oh, we don't know what's in the backpack, do we? Because what do we do with sin? These are the things we hide. And he's saying, even the things other people can't see, you lay them aside because they will ensnare you, they will entangle you, because they will trip him up. Sin gets you disqualified, puts you out of the race. That means there's no prize for you. That means you are sidelined. Doesn't mean you're not saved. It means you're sidelined. Consider carefully so that you do not weaken and you do not fall. That's the next verb he goes to, verse 3. Consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. The Greek word there is faint, losing heart, giving up. Consider him, consider everything he went through for us, terrible hostility. And he didn't give up. He didn't lose heart. He didn't quit. He's encouraging them, don't give up. Don't quit. Now, what about the middle section? He disciplines us. He disciplines us so that we can share in his holiness. We don't run the race on our own. The word discipline, we get the word disciple. A disciple is a son. We get the word discipleship. Discipleship is sonship. The son who represents the one who is his father. A good disciple represents his father faithfully. 12:1-3, call to run. Why suffering? See, discipline, we think, sometimes is suffering. We get it mixed up. Why suffering? Well, 12:6. Well, let's go back to 4. You have not resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin. You have not resisted temptation or the people who are hostile toward you. You have not resisted them. And you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. So suffering in 12:6, we find out, is evidence. Evidence that not that God does not love us, it's evidence that he does love us. That's his first point. What he's saying in a kind of a nice way is, look, this hasn't killed you yet. You haven't died. He resisted to the point of death. You haven't died. And not only have you not resisted, you have forgotten. You have lost focus. He says in verse 5, you've forgotten the exhortation addressed to you as sons. You've forgotten your Old Testaments, the book of Proverbs. You've forgotten it. In 12:7, he goes on to say that discipline strengthens us. It's for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? A good father disciplines his children. Discipline doesn't always mean a rod. Discipline also means reward, encouragement, praise. Disciplining is a balanced, loving act in order to make your children grow up to be responsible, faithful adults. Adversities that come in our lives are resistance. They're things that block us from getting what we want. That's a good thing. It strengthens us to make the right choices. The purpose of discipline is to get you to endure, is to make you more endurable. Not adorable. Endurable. This word endure, he picks up verse 1. Therefore, we have a great cloud of witnesses. Look at, let us run with endurance. It's in verse 2. For the joy set before him endured the cross. Look at verse 3. Consider him who has endured such hostility. And then we come down here to verse 7. 4 times in those 7 verses. It is for discipline that you endure. You're being disciplined so that you can be like Jesus and endure hostility. Are they experiencing hostility? Yes. If you fix your focus on Jesus and think about him, you can endure this. He did, and he's leading you through it. And again, you can't discount that when you make the choice to fix on Jesus and to endure, God then begins to work in your life. It's that God works within you. It's not, you're not in this by yourself. And of course, we can't be in this by ourselves because we're part of a church and we have other people to encourage us as well. This goes back and starts where we started this, really the flow through from the section is 10:36. 10:36, you have need of what? How are you going to get it? Discipline. I listen to John MacArthur on this section and I like him. I like to listen to him. And he makes a very good point when he says in verse 8, we're going to go to that next. Because what discipline does, it legitimizes us. If we're being disciplined by God, why are we being disciplined by God? Because we're sons. We're legitimate. So it legitimizes us. So look at verse 7. It is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as sons. 8. But if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. If I really got it easy and I was no opposition, I go to a church and I sometimes talk about Jesus. John MacArthur makes a good point, and as a pastor, I appreciate his position. As a pastor of a very large church and a seminary, he says, I know that I have people in this congregation that are not saved. And every pastor has that knowledge. Every pastor knows there are people in his pews that are not Christians. They pose as Christians. Maybe God is working with them and drawing them. But you know, the dark side of it is, there are people in the congregation whose purpose is to undermine. There are wolves among sheep. They're there to divide and undermine and to create doubt and to lead people away from Jesus Christ. When we start thinking that we have a church that's pure, we've forgotten what Jesus told his disciples. There's going to be tares among the wheat, and we can't separate them out. Now, the closer we get to somebody, the more we may realize, yes, this person's a believer. I can tell by the character in their life. They live by the principles that are taught by Jesus Christ in the Bible. Principles before personalities. Don't want to fall in the trap and say, that guy's such a wonderful guy. Yeah, I know a lot of his doctrine is really screwball, but he's such a neat guy and everybody likes him. There you're in trouble. The principles of the Bible must be predominant. The personality of the person doesn't matter if they're going to lead you astray. You want to avoid them. So John MacArthur says, I know there's people out there who aren't believers. Where he pushes it too far, and where I disagree, that people who endure are the only true Christians. And that's where he pushes it too far. Because the writer of the book of Hebrews is not arguing that if you don't endure, it's because you're not saved. No. He's watching some of them fail. And he knows they're Christians. He knows they're saved. You need endurance to follow Jesus Christ. Why would the unbeliever need endurance? Believers need endurance so that we win the prize, so that we get all that we can get at the Bema Seat that God has planned for us. Or we can lose it all. Moses lost it all. It was one of his arguments in the book. Some of the people who came out of Egypt lost their lives because they disobeyed God. We face that peril as believers. Now, point he makes here, we have no discipline at all in our lives. I'm in a church and I'm living my own life and maybe doing immoral things on the side and there's no repercussions in my life. You got to wonder, that guy might be illegitimate. He may not be a son. And will he endure persecution? No, when the persecution comes, he's out the door. That's what he's saying. One of the last things it says, it prepares us, 12:10. If we read down through 9, furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? Now, what he's doing is contrasting fleshly fathers. The Greek says fleshly fathers. Fleshly fathers. We all have different fathers. But as Christians, we only have one spiritual father. His discipline is better. They discipline for what seemed best to them, sometimes for their good, not simply for ours. But God only disciplines us for our good. It's to prepare us. He disciplines us for our own good so that we may share His holiness. He's willing to share with us. The thing that we get mixed up on here, discipline is not judgment. Discipline is painful, but it's not judgment. And even if we're suffering consequences of sin, and we know that God is bringing those consequences as a megaphone in our head to get us to turn toward Him, it's not judgment. It is discipline. It looks like judgment, though. And it looks like we've fallen into the hands of an angry God. Sin does grieve God. It does grieve the Holy Spirit. Sin does anger God. Parents do get angry with their children. But anger is not the driving force of correction. The driving force of correction is love. And God's love is always what motivates Him to discipline us. Verse 11, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful. That's an understatement. But sorrowful, especially if it's harsh. He's talking about harsh discipline here. He's talking about them being persecuted. What he's telling them and trying to get through to their heads is, your persecution from these Gentiles and the Jewish leaders who drove you out because you're Jewish Christians, who drove you out of Jerusalem, that's painful. That's sorrowful. Yet those who have been trained by it, this is part of your training. Afterwards, it yields a peaceful fruit of righteousness. Those who have been disciplined, trained by discipline, find that discipline produces the peaceful fruit of righteousness. He said that before in 5:12 through 14. You may want to turn back there if you want to follow along in the text. He said in 5:12 through 14, he said the same thing using a metaphor, food, milk, and meat. You have come to need milk and not solid food. You're not accustomed to the word of righteousness, which is meat. You're an infant, what he's saying. You're babies. You should be grown and mature, but you're not. You should be teaching, but you're not. Solid food is for the mature. That's the disciplined. the disciplined, who because of practice, that is training, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. That means they do the right things. No, it's not just the right things. They do the best things. Maturity is learning to do the best things for God. What he's done in 12, run the race, lay down the encumbrances, turn away from the sin which entangles you, is saying exactly the same thing. Because if you do that, you will mature and you will begin to understand and be able to discern not only good from evil, but better from best. And sometimes we trip over that. We'll settle for what's good and not say, Lord, help me get to the best. I struggle with that all the time when I study, when I teach. Maybe this is good enough. And I reach a point where I go, no, it's not good enough. In fact, I teach here every Sunday. It's never good enough for me. John MacArthur said this to another pastor. He said, some days I wonder if what I'm doing makes any difference at all. And that encouraged me. I went, if John MacArthur can say that, I've got to try to do the best I can do. But he's saying in 5:12, they're like babies. They're not like full-grown mature sons. And he's warning them in 12, if you stumble because of encumbrances or sin, you will not go on to maturity. You will not have a testimony. You will not gain God's approval. So now he closes. Having said that, he closes. We're down to verse 12. Call to run. Now we're at the call to renew. Why suffering is in between. 12 through 13, a call to renew. Let's look at that. What he's going to do, 12, 13, let's read that. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame, or so that the lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. This is great. This is an orthopedic metaphor. Is this guy in the race? If you're on crutches, you're not in the race. You need to be healed. This is what he wants you to picture. Someone that's got a foot that's out of joint. He says, I want you to be healed so that you can stay in the race. Because if you don't get healed, you cannot be in the race. You cannot be effective. You cannot mature. And the goal of Christianity is not to get saved and then wait to go to heaven. The goal of Christianity is to obtain a testimony where God can say, well done. That's maturing. That's going toward perfection. Now, he talks about hands. That's orthopedic. He talks about knees. That's certainly orthopedic. He talks about feet. And that's orthopedic. So it's an orthopedic picture, orthopedic metaphor. But what does he mean? Is he interested in orthopedics? I don't think so. He says your hands are weak. If you have weak hands, how's that going to affect your work? Your work for Jesus. If you have feeble knees, what does that say about your prayer life? I think, you know, in these days they would kneel to pray, as you see Muslims do. Kind of a Middle Eastern thing. Someone said about James, Jesus' brother, Jesus' half-brother, that he prayed so much he had knees like a camel. So what about lame feet? Well, that's your walk. He doesn't say fix your feet, straighten your feet, which is the word straight paths there. That is the word orthos, where we get the word orthopedic. But make straight paths for your feet. It doesn't say fix your feet. It says strengthen your hands and your feeble knees. Strengthen those. Your work and your prayer. But your walk? Well, that has a lot to do with the path you're on. So that ties back to what he said at the very beginning, the encumbrances. What if there's a bunch of junk in the path? Get the obstacles off the track. Because not only can there be obstacles on your back, there can be obstacles on the track. Clear the way. Straighten that path. Because the straighter that path is, the less likely you are to step on something and break your ankle. So that which is lame may not be put out of joint. I mean, if you've got a weak hand, a weak knee, or a weak foot, you don't want anything else to trip you up. He's saying you strengthen what you see as weak in your life. And you get straight what you know is in your path, is what's crooked in your life. Get strong and get straight, or you will be put out of commission. You'll be disqualified. You won't be in a race. You'll be a spectator on the sidelines, on crutches with a cast on your foot. But rather, or better, be healed. Who's going to heal you? The Lord will heal you. Look at Paul, what he says. 1 Corinthians 9:27. Where's discipline come from? Well, discipline can come from yourself. Paul said, I discipline my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, what? Be disqualified. He uses the analogy of the runner in the race in his book. So that you may not be taken out of the race. Is Paul saying, I'm going to lose my salvation?
No, lose his prize, lose his reward,
lose his testimony. We don't think in terms of salvation as a testimony. We think in terms of salvation as, well, I'm going to heaven. I believed in Jesus, and now I'm going to heaven. All I have to do is wait to go. If God didn't want to give us his approval, and he didn't need us as a group of people to testify for him, we could believe in Jesus and be taken home immediately. Why would he have to leave us here? Believe in him and then go. You're done. It's not the way he does it. So notice here, Paul's discipline is I know I need discipline, and so he disciplines himself. But he needs the Lord's as well, and he knows that. Why does he need God's discipline in his life? Discipline assures us of what? That we're legitimate children and that God loves us. So Paul needs the Lord's discipline as well. He says, I need to know that God loves me. And I'll only know that if he corrects me, if he disciplines me. Paul complained about having a thorn in the flesh. He said, God, take it away. God says, no, my grace is sufficient for you. You keep that thorn. I gave that to you. You might think it's from Satan, but the devil's my devil. I control what he does. And he put that thorn in your flesh. Now, I'm going to leave it there because my grace is sufficient for you. What did that tell Paul? Oh, Lord, you do love me. Let's close with this. Let's go back to the book of Proverbs. Go to the book of Proverbs. Go to chapter 3. Go to verse 5. These are the verses that he quoted. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5. Trust in the Lord. Believe in the Lord with all your heart. And do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. I thought he told us in Hebrews, straighten your own path. Well, how are we really going to get the power to straighten our own path? If we trust in the Lord, he'll do it. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. It will be healing to your body and refreshment to your bones. Be healed, right? That lameness, who will heal that? The Lord will heal that. How? You turn to him and trust him. Verse 9, honor the Lord with your wealth and from the first of all your produce, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. If I honor the Lord, he will provide. Does that mean if I honor the Lord, I'm going to get rich? No. If I honor the Lord, he will give me what I need. Seek you first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added unto you. And what are the things? What I wear, what I eat, and where I live. God provides. Is it ever enough for me? No. It's never enough for me as Tim. But for me as a son of the Father, it's enough. To be rich is to have enough. Is to have enough. And no matter how rich you are, if you want more, are you ever going to be satisfied? Verse 11, close here. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord, or loathe his reproof. That's despise it. For whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father the son in whom he delights. And if you trust him, he'll heal you, he will make your path straight, and you'll be able to follow him. Because we're not in this alone. Next week, we're going to look at the dark side of this for a bit. Apostasy is an ever-present danger for the believer, and there's always going to be elements in our society and people in our church who are going to push us this way. Finding the best and straightest path for the race is our challenge. The best and the straightest path. And so the thing you have to remember about the book of Hebrews and maturity, it's a marathon. It's a long-term race. When it says run with endurance, it's a long, long marathon. It's not a sprint. So you got to pace yourself. And that's what we're going to do next week. Dear Father, we thank you so much for your grace and so much for your mercy. And so much for the knowledge that the discipline...